Spirit Radio Podcasts.
The European elections taking place this Friday, the 24th of May, as I was telling you yesterday, along with the local elections and a divorce referendum. It's really a big deal. Get out there, folks, and vote. Don't forget. It's a brief opportunity to look at our relationship with the EU and the influence that elected representatives to the European Parliament can have on EU policies and the lives of the 500 million plus who live within the EU. Our next guest is running for election in the Dublin constituency and is a founding member of a party that believes Ireland would be better off outside the European Union. In studio to tell us more, we have Herman Kelly and yes, Herman, you're very, very welcome.
Thank you, Ronan.
From the Irish Freedom Party, and with him is his running mate, Ben Scallon. How are you, Ben?
Hello.
Both very welcome to the show. First of all, Herman, tell us about yourself and just give us a bit of a sense of, you know, why you've decided to run for election.
Yes.
Because I know that you have a background in Europe, but just give us a sense of it.
Well, I'm from Derry originally. I was a teacher, a religious education teacher in Dublin secondary schools. I then became a journalist. I actually once edited the Irish Catholic for my sins.
Oh, the Irish Catholic. Yeah, of course.
Then I went on as a columnist for the Irish Examiner, Mail on Sunday, became a press officer, and I've been a director of communications for one of the eight groups in the European Parliament for the last 9 years. So it's 43 MEPs of seven different nationalities. They'd be Eurosceptic and socially conservative the group.
Now, it's funny, I know in general we believe in Ireland that people are, you know, maybe not fans of the EU, but, you know, I always say, like, there's a kind of a healthy scepticism, but at the same time.
Yeah, well, we had the referendum, Nice won, referendum, Lisbon won, majority of people in both cases voted no. Like, thing is, Irish people fought for 800 years for Irish self-determination to get rid of, leave one political empire, one political union, which was the British Empire. And why are we handing over all this power to Brussels, another political union of which we're 1%, and, like, basically that means that old men who we didn't elect, we can't get rid of, make EU laws which are imposed upon us. And the problem is that in matters of EU competence, EU regulations are supreme over Irish law, over the Supreme Court, and over our constitution. That is not, quote, the unfettered control of Irish destinies. So that's subservience.
So your sense is it's largely about sovereignty, then, is it?
Sovereignty is always been my driving thing. Yeah.
It takes a man from Derry to have you sensitive to such things.
Yeah, well, I think growing up in the Troubles in Derry, for us it was very much a living reality.
Well, it's much more alive than for, say, you know, the people who are, like, who encountered those kind of issues maybe 100 years back, but, you know, that is not 100 years back for people who live in Derry.
Yeah, well, people, Balbriggan, I was canvassing there in Balbriggan there 2 weeks ago. I got a great reception, actually, and it was along this street, it begins with C, I can't remember the name of the street, but basically it was a short street, about 80 yards, got 10 votes in that area, and I was meeting another guy later, and he says, and everybody knows about the burning of Balbriggan by the Black and Tans.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And he says, yeah, that's the street that was burned down. It was thatched at the time.
Wow.
But I just think, look, the EU hasn't been all good. There was an argument that could be made in the 70s because of trade tariffs going to the EU. But these people now, they make a huge percentage of our laws. They've imposed 64 billion bank debt. And the consequences of that for ordinary people is austerity. It's property taxes, carbon taxes, water charges. I think we're now a net contributor to the EU budget of 1 billion last year. Yeah. 1 billion euro net into the EU budget. We can't afford the EU anymore.
Having said that, 1 billion is very much small fry compared with what some of the bigger companies are putting in.
Well, compared to the...
And compared with what we're getting out of it. I mean, it's...
Well,
it's,
getting out of it is...
I mean, we may not be getting...
A raft of legislation made by people that we didn't elect. Yeah, what's good and democratic about that?
Well, now, in fairness, we have elected them. Like, the Council of Ministers, we've elected the Council of Ministers.
We have one vote. We have one vote out
sure.
of... Actually, less. We're 1% of the EU population. So at the Council of Ministers, we have less than 1% of the votes. We have one European Commission. Do you know the European Commission has the sole right to initiate law in the EU? the soul, right? So the parliament is like a democratic facade over a very undemocratic institution. But anyway, but there's other policies as well.
But in fair, I'm just I need to comment on that because I don't want to be people phoning in here going, "You let them off the hook."
Yeah.
I mean, the reality is that you know when the every single update, if you like, every single upgrade of the parliament, the parliament has more power. And has had done, you know, historically, like whether it's Nice, Lisbon, or each time.
It has had over the budget.
Whereas, you know, at the beginning, it really had no. So it's like there's this kind of an awareness within Europe that it has to be made more democratic. Yeah, do you not agree with that?
But what is wrong with the fact that the vast majority of countries in this world, there's about 200 countries in the UN, apart from those in the EU, the 27, soon to be 28, soon to be 27, the vast majority of them are sovereign, they're independent, they make their own laws for the benefit of their own people. And the thing is, when people make their own laws, those who represent them are accountable. And the problem is that people, MPs and commissioners in Budapest and Bratislava, they are not accountable to us, those who are impacted by these laws. So I think, look, we're better off out, make our own laws, make our own budgets, decide our own destiny. And like, look at the... We had boom and bust there just a number of years ago. We were in the euro. We had cheap credit. We were opened up after Nice won. We had cheap labour from Eastern Europe. Cheap labour, cheap credit. We had a building boom and bust. And then in 2012, 152,000 people had to emigrate out of Ireland. So let's not say that it's all been good. It hasn't been good. Well, and from that,
I don't think anybody would suggest that it has been good. To me, the great tragedy of Britain using leaving is because used to give us great cover, because when things came up that we didn't like, they invariably didn't like it even more. Like, so they stopped us.
And
I agree, exposed in a certain way. But, and this is really a big thing, wouldn't you agree it's much, much better to influence the EU from within? I mean, this has been the big story, hasn't it, been in the UK? If you're not within, you know, then you're a law taker rather than actually in some way. And, you know, we have
outside the EU can determine your own laws. Within, the laws are imposed upon you.
But you can't really... you know, when it comes to things like trade and all the rest, with those, let's be honest, we've spent the last 40, 50 years building up that in order to overcome our reliance on the UK.
Yeah, well, the UK tried to reform the EU for 40 years, obviously found it impossible.
They said,
okay, we're up and sticking, we're leaving.
Absolutely disagree with you. I think every single thing they asked for, they got, except for maybe a handful of things.
Well, the majority of the people in Britain voted to leave, so that's their democratic
just about,
right.
Just about a majority.
It would be great if Irish people found the rebel spirit once again so that we could make our own laws again. Lord, why leave one political union to join another?
And, you know, I'm sensitive. I do appreciate that.
But there's our policies as well. I'd like to emphasise that Irish Freedom Party, we're a pro-natalist, pro-life party that believes in supporting life. Opposed to abortion. I find it barbaric that last week HSE guidelines were talking about flushing aborted children down the toilet. It's just unbelievable. The thing, we have pro-natalist policies to encourage, incentivize families to have children. We believe that no country has a future without children. So a bit like Hungary, we want to buy tax system to incentivize families to have children, to help them get a house. Actually, that's one of the things that I'm touched on a lot when I'm canvassing around in Dublin. I was in Coolock there last night. A woman came to the door. She says, I just want to be able to buy a house.
Yeah. Like, it's the issue,
isn't it? I came back from Scotland. She said, me and my husband, we're both working, and the kids were in the background, I could see. She says, we just can't buy a house. I can't afford a house.
Exactly.
And one of the aspects that I also bring up is, like, the population of Ireland has increased by 1 million in the last 20 years.
That's right.
The government wants to increase it by an additional 1 million by 2040. Like, increased demand for housing pushes up prices for houses, also pushes up rents. And people, like, there was a survey there last week which showed that the number of houses, apartments for rent, is at its lowest level ever, and rents are at its highest. There is a relationship between immigration, demand for housing, and prices. And it's basically becoming people just can't afford to buy a house or rent a place. And we just got to say that we need control of the numbers of people coming in here, because basically demand, like, you can't build a house in every field in Ireland to house everybody who wants to come here.
Absolutely.
It's not, and really, I certainly don't feel a moral duty that Irish people have to house the world. It's not our, I don't know, I think it's
absolutely. I mean, I appreciate what you're saying there, but do you know the kind of idea of, do you have any sense that there is actually no real housing policy, or at least the housing policy that is there at the moment isn't really effective, isn't fit for purpose?
Yeah,
or are you saying really this is all down to immigration?
No, it's not all down to immigration. It's a major factor.
Okay.
Now, there's other issues to do with lack of supply of housing.
Exactly.
About planning law, about people able to build houses. You also have government support and tax incentives for vulture funds, which are kicking people out of that. There's a friend of mine here in Sandymount who's been kicked out of his apartment at the moment.
Yeah.
He's actually talking about having a protest outside the RTB at the minute. And then even I found there a few weeks ago about cuckoo funds as well, about multinational companies with tax incentives from the government can buy up vast amounts of newly built houses. And it means that people looking for an apartment, private owners or would-be owners, can't buy a place. So you have all these factors, but I think the major, economics is about supply and demand. And when demand, you cannot control demand, prices go through the roof, and that's what's happened.
No doubt. Listen, thank you, Herman. Ben, I don't want to just leave you sitting there quietly listening to what Herman says.
I'm just learning from the master.
Yeah, absolutely. Why is it that you have gotten involved in Herman's campaign?
Well, there was an EFDD meeting. It was the first Irexit meeting last February, and Nigel Farage attended. Herman Kelly was speaking at it, and I didn't know him at that point. I was just an attendee in the audience, and I had been a Eurosceptic for a long time. And I remember looking up and thinking, I don't know what's going on here or where this is going to go, but I want to be a part of it. And so several months later, in September, they were having the party launch and it was all taking off, and I thought, look, what do I have to lose, you know? So I messaged Herman and I said, here, I'm passionate about this issue, could I speak at this event? And we met up, we talked, he kind of liked the idea, so we agreed, and then sure enough, I've been involved with it ever since. And I really want my country back. I hear about the way things were before my time. I'm a young guy, you know, there's a lot of these things that I wasn't even around for, but I didn't get a chance to exercise my democratic will then, and I don't want to wait until it's too late.
Yeah.
There's other pro-life speakers at the event in September as well, like Paddy Manning, who's very well known, and Ray Kinsler, who's a good supporter. So I think, as I said, we're
Ray has turned out to be quite Eurosceptic
as well,
hasn't he?
Actually, he published a book with his son there a few months ago, Troikonomics, basically speaking about the EU Commission's and ECB's treatment of disgraceful treatment of, like, people of Greece, Spain, Portugal, Ireland. Even the IMF criticised the EU's ECB's treatment of Ireland at the time of what they call it a bailout, but really it was the Irish taxpayer was stitched up with someone else's debt. And we're going to take the consequences. So my preferred option is we take back democratic control of our own country, make laws for our own benefit.
Absolutely. Well, listen, it is lovely to speak to you both, Herman Kelly and Ben Scallon. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I wish you the very best on Friday. As well as European elections, we also have the local elections on Friday. One of the many people who is out canvassing and talking to people about local issues is our next guest. She's running for Inua in the Athenry Oranmore electoral area in County Galway. And on the line now to tell us more, we have Amanda McManus. You're very welcome to the show, Amanda. First of all, Amanda, what's it like getting out and about and talking to people on the doorsteps?
Ronan, I'm really enjoying getting out, meeting people. Most people actually are very nice at the door. They're discussing what their issues are. And but there is a lot of frustration, you'd say, with politicians, and people kind of angry with past politicians. But a lot of people that I've spoke to are being very nice.
And am I right in saying your background is in social work?
I'm a social care worker. So for the last 11 years, I have worked with people within the community. So I've worked in family support, community development, domestic violence, disability, yeah. elderly and addiction and homelessness.
So in a way you come with a very different kind of an energy to the doorstep, don't you? Because you're, first of all, you probably have a natural listening ability and all that kind of stuff, and then you come in and when they realise that actually you're not one of those politicians.
Yeah, you might be
trying to be one, but you're not actually one currently.
No. that's the problem. I've too much empathy for people, really. I'm just kind of, I can really understand the underlying issues that people are going through, you know.
I can well imagine it, and certainly after years as a social care worker, I can imagine. What are the kind of issues that people kind of bring up with you when you're on the doorstep?
A lot of the issues that have been brought to my attention is the likes of isolation and loneliness is a big one for the elderly.
Sure.
Especially in the rural parts of my local election. People are feeling, you know, that with their family moved on or their partners might have passed away, that they just have no one calling to them, so they're feeling very lonely.
Absolutely.
Also, they're finding it very hard to get into their shop, and there's only one supermarket in one of the areas that I'm running for election.
Yeah.
Also, what came to my attention quite a lot is the lack of support people are getting within as carers. You know, that are looking after their family members or
Absolutely.
Their children.
I'd imagine there's quite a bit of isolation for them too. You know, people who are kind of, you know, a lot of the time, you know, looking after, say, one other person, maybe in some cases even two. But, you know, first of all, you know, they're trying to survive on a carer's allowance, but also they can be kind of, you know, you can get lonely, you can get lack, you know, the only people that you're kind of dealing with are the people who are so dependent on you.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Now, I was at a carers meeting last Friday in Tuam, and there was a lot of outrage, we'd say, within the carers. And they spoke about, like, even when they do get relief time for an hour or two, that they have to be present in the house. Because
yeah.
they can't even leave the house to go and, we'd say, do something for themselves, for their own self-care, because they are feeling quite burnt out and frustrated.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny, you were talking earlier on about the kind of, and there's been a lot of talk over the years about rural isolation, but it's not, from what you're saying, it's not just purely rural isolation, that actually, you know, you're in Athenry and Oranmore, and they're, you know, reasonably kind of, they're not exactly urban, but they're well built up areas, so
yeah.
those elderly and carers in those areas are experiencing isolation too.
Yeah. I think a lot of it comes down to, we say, when people get to a certain age, they just like to go home. There's not enough support and activities being run for elderly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's the problem. They've no get up and go. So if they were influenced to get up and go and do something, like I used to help run a little program. It was called Younger Heart.
Yeah.
So we used to do a program where the elderly would just go out and organise a bus, and we'd go to the cinema, and we'd go bring them for a meal and bring them to a national park, and they used to love that.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be just a tiny thing can make a massive, massive impact on people.
Yes.
We had Herman Kelly and Ben Scallon in just only a few minutes ago, and they were talking about housing, and that seems to be something that's coming up for you as well.
Oh yeah, housing is a big issue at the moment. People are just getting very frustrated at the moment because there's a lot of working families, we'd say, that is working, but they're paying a lot of high tax. So what's happening is they're not getting the opportunity, we'd say, to save. They're in house, and then the landlords are selling the houses up. And these families then are not, they don't qualify for social houses because they earn too much.
Yeah, they're on the borderline between getting a social house and then not being able to afford one. That's really, I always feel very sorry for those people.
Yeah, there's a lot of frustration now, what I'm hearing at the door because of that issue. So Renew's policy is to try and reduce people's tax, working families' tax, so they can try and get save and have the opportunity to be able to maybe apply for affordable housing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really, yeah, interesting. So in terms of, I know we've spoken a little bit about carers and we spoke about housing, mm-hmm. but you have some sense of youth services, the challenges facing young people as well. What do you think are the big issues facing young people in your area?
I think the biggest challenges facing the young people at this stage is just not enough activities up and running for them.
Yeah.
I find kids are getting bored, it's causing a lot of antisocial behaviour, and between the age of 14 really and 16, kids, even the stuff that's going on, the sports, they're starting to lose interest, they want to be out with their friends. I would propose really what would work, because kids love making money, is the youth employment scheme. is getting children up at that age when they're on school holidays, getting them trained up on something they would enjoy doing and getting them a little wage out of it. And that will start, put a stop to some of the antisocial behaviour. They're just bored out in the streets and they haven't got really anywhere to go, especially in Athenry. There's no place to go for kids of that age. They have one small park for younger kids and that's it.
Yeah, absolutely. I know in your background that before you were into a social care worker that you also were in the army.
Yes.
Are you campaigning on any issues affecting, you know, like the Defence Forces or Defence Force families or anything like that?
Yeah, we are putting in, we are hoping to support the Defence Forces for over the next 10 years.
Yeah.
We're hoping to look at the likes of their wages and the minimum payments they get at the moment for 24 hours, usually, like, it's only 20 euros at the moment. So we're hoping to increase that up to at least the minimum wage, 980. And also to put a lot more supports in place for themselves and their families, because, like, that life can be very lonely and isolating for families when their husbands or their wives go overseas and they're on their own with their kids and their kids also not seeing their parents for 6 months when they're away.
Yeah, I'm listening to you here, Amanda, and I'm thinking, you know, here you are, you're going for the county council, you know, with Renua, and you're hoping to get yourself a seat. What's it like, you know, what's it like kind of going up to the first door that you knock on? You know, you've got your background in social care, you've had a background in army as well, and you know, suddenly you're going, I am Amanda McManus, politician, knocking on somebody's door. What is that like?
I have to say, the first few doors, I don't know, it was kind of nerve-wracking. But after that, it kind of built my confidence a bit more. The more people, like especially the elderly and people we'd say that had issues with previous politicians, as soon as I actually got speaking to them and made them see that, look, I'm not like everybody else.
Yeah.
I give them a little breakdown of my background and how I can help support them and how I've worked in the areas. I've done a lot of work behind closed doors because I am a family support worker and I also work in domestic violence. So I'm not a person that's out in the streets that everyone knows my name or sees my face. But families know who I am from behind closed doors. So I've been getting a lot of support that way, and people are very angry. And in a way, a lot of them are hoping that I will get through because I can help them with some of the issues they are experiencing. But it is, I'm feeling a bit more confident, the more I am doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, I wish you the very best with it and all the best on Friday. But before you go, Amanda, you're involved in the charity Gianna Care and you've an event this weekend. Can you tell us about that?
Gianna Care is doing a fundraising event on this Saturday, the 25th.
Okay.
People can register through giannacare.com, eventsmart.com, and it costs 10 euros to register. There's some lovely walks going along on it, and it's just a fundraiser to bring events so we can help support women in crisis and help them in every way we can, because we do a lot for them and we don't get any funding for Gianna Care. So everything we do, we have to do through fundraising.
Okay, so 5 kilometre walk to help raise funds for Crisis Pregnancy Centre Care, Gianna Care, May the 25th, 2019. And it's nationwide, is it?
It is nationwide, yes.
Nationwide, brilliant. Amanda McManus running as candidate for Renua in the Oranmore Athenry electoral area in County Galway. Thank you so much for speaking to us this morning.
Thank you for having me, Ronan. Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye. The European elections come at a strange time with the shadow of Brexit hanging over the EU and considerable doubt over whether certain MEPs will take up their seats and for how long. You could say that this situation devalues the election, but our next guest is of the opinion that these elections, and indeed the local elections, are especially important. In studio now, to tell us more, we have economist and author Ray Kinsella. You are very welcome to the show, Ray.
Many thanks, Ronan.
First of all, Ray, why do you think these particular elections are especially important?
Well, all elections are important, Ronan, but these ones are pivotal. In Europe, there are tectonic forces clashing. Now, that's caricatured by the establishment as populism against Europe. In fact, it goes much deeper than that. I think the second reason why these are so important is they represent a change in regime.
Yeah.
The Commission that in effect was in place during the terrible years of austerity and troikonomics, that's gone. So there will be a new president of the European Commission. There'll be a new president of the European Central Bank. And that's important. And obviously a whole new European Parliament. This is a period of change.
Yeah, it really is. And I love the way you're kind of saying we're talking about tectonic plates, like these kind of forces moving. And, you know, of course, the PR on one side says the other thing is populism, and the forces on populism say Europe is broken. So you kind of have these. But really, what it would be lovely to be able to see, what do you think are the kind of underlying philosophies that are really warring it out in there?
Ronan, that's a really interesting question. In the book, their recent book on Troikonomics, myself and Morris, the philosopher, tried to put it this way. What we're looking at is a clash between hegemony, that's control from the centre, which is not really what Europe was supposed to be about, and autonomy, that is from the side where countries are seeking to, quote, return more power. Now, that's caricatured as a clash between nationalists, the far right, and all the rest of it, and the stable centre. But like I said, it goes much deeper. It is right and proper to try to keep the spirit of a community of nations.
Mm.
It's right and proper to try to come up with more sensible and representative structures in Europe. I think what people forget is that nationalism is important, where the nation concerned is aware of the responsibilities it has for its people, but also understands that autonomy is something that is relational, that is where, like all of us, where you become yourself more fully by engaging with others.
Yeah.
Now, Europe really hasn't addressed that issue, how to align the two, how to accept that countries do have rights and responsibilities in relation to their governance and their economics. And at the same time, Europe was once an extraordinary adventure, an extraordinary achievement.
And this kind of idea that, in a way, almost like the ecumenical idea that actually in being truly united, we can only really truly be united if we remain true to who we are individually. There's something in that, isn't there?
There is a huge amount in that. I mean, what we're looking at, we have an understanding of what autonomy means for a person, to grow towards a greater understanding of who you are, what you are about, and the capacity to engage with other people on that basis. We need each other.
Sorry for interrupting you there, but just to clarify for myself. So is it the feeling that you have that actually, rather than actually becoming more ourselves, that we're actually turning into this kind of bland centre thing?
It's not bland. It's very hard-edged. I mean, for example, if you look at, well, we looked at the examples of Greece and one or two other countries when we were looking at austerity and what was happening, what lay behind the position that we're now in, Ronan, where there is this clash. And for example, if you look at Italy at the moment, 10% of the people unemployed, a truly massive debt burden, been 130%, and yet Europe at the centre is arguing about whether the deficit should be 3 or 3.5%. I mean, that's voodoo economics.
Explain to me now. You understand why that, because this is your area. Why is that voodoo? Is it because what Europe are asking for is just unrealistic?
Yes, it is unrealistic. Where you have the period of austerity was truly existential. When you look at what happened in Ireland and the legacy that we look at today, when you look at Italy or Greece and the legacy of the Troika,
And again, I'm sorry for cutting across you, as I know you have stuff to say, but it's just so that I'm clear. When you talk about the legacy, do you mean the, I don't even know, is it 42 billion at this stage, but whatever it is that's left over, or is it to do with the kind of the homelessness and that kind of crisis, or is it some melange of all?
Well, that's a really interesting way of putting it, and I'm sure listeners will have their own view. Let's take a few countries. Germany and France set the tone for how countries should adapt to the banking and debt crisis. Mm. And they chose to do that by imposing an extraordinary degree of austerity on countries, so that, in effect, countries lost control, not just of their economy, but of their governance. Exactly the same in Greece. Greece hasn't escaped from that. The legacy of that is still in Greece. Equally in Ireland, you have an economy that's doing very well, but not for everybody. Mm. For many families who have sons and daughters listening this morning, they can't get an affordable house.
And you think that's a legacy specifically of austerity?
Yeah, that's a legacy, because really the same kind of forces of engagement, of dialogue, and looking for the best in people that we would look for in Ireland, and it's not there. We would look for that in Europe. And instead, what we see in Europe, and this is a real problem, because Europe used to be like this. It was a community. When we look at Europe, we see the huge contrast between the economic data for Italy and for Germany. Hmm. We look at France, and we see a country that encapsulates the enlargement of Europe, more Europe, and yet we see people on the streets protesting. Now, these are not populists. These are not extreme right-wing people. They are countries and people in pain. You know, where you have 10% unemployment, where you have an insurmountable debt problem, where you have people saying that looking at where Europe has taken us, the most recent BBC indicators show that the big issues that people are concerned about include emigration. Now, why is that? It's because it was badly handled in Europe. It was imposed, just like Europe, imposed for the best of reasons, but there wasn't any engagement in saying, how can we do this?
Nobody said, what does everybody think about this?
That's right. Yeah. People are concerned about the issue of climate change, and that's good, but it hasn't been properly addressed at a European level. So again, the feeling is that certain dictatorial forces are imposing these changes on Europe.
People don't like to be told what to do. Well, they react to that, don't they?
Yeah, there is a great parallel between how we like to be treated as individuals and how countries should engage with each other. Courtesy, consensus. For example, Ronan, if we look at courtesy and consensus are really important. If you look at the model that was the very basis for the recovery of Germany and for Europe, the Christian democratic model, that's not there, that's been eroded. So Christianity has been displaced, and that's a big issue, because it's been succeeded by a secularist ideology that's very impressive. Democracy is not there because people feel alienated from what's happening in Europe. It's important to restore a degree of trust that's not there. And when I say these elections are really important, they're important for that reason. If you don't have trust, if you don't have engagement, if you don't have a way of tackling big problems that brings countries together and respects that autonomy, you will see a continued fracturing of Europe. And I think that's what they're concerned about.
So, Ray, what's to be done?
Well, I mentioned the I mentioned the Christian democratic model because people like Adenauer and Jean Monnet, they had a real grasp of what it was about, but more importantly, they lived that out in their own life. Somewhere along the line, we've lost that sense of solidarity. There has been much talk in the past about a social Europe. It's not there, and that's why people are protesting. What's to be done? I think choices have to be made. For example, in our own country, the changes that have happened in the last 5 years have been seismic, and the changes not only socially but also economically. For example, 5 years ago, 5-6 years period, the definition of marriage has changed. The legalization of abortion has been enacted. The imposition of an ideology of gender theory has been imposed in schools. Now, there are people who will be voting who will say, yeah, that's a good thing. The terms mother and father shouldn't be there. We should have a different approach. But equally, Ronan, there's another group of people, probably 30-35%, who feel crowded out, who look at the main political parties and say, they're not what they were. They represent something radically different to their foundational values. And you know what? Between the three mainstream parties, there is very little difference. So what's to be done? I think what's really encouraging is that now, for this election, we see the emergence of new parties. Now, I'm not party political myself, I want to make that clear. But when I look at parties like ANPU, and I see an emphasis on social justice, on unity by consent, on life. Oh. And when I look at freedom to exit, whether or not you take whatever view you take on that issue, it's taking people in who have been left out in the cold. Oh. Voters who have been left out in the cold suddenly have a representation for their views, equally with Renew. And what I think is also great is that around the country, there are so many independent candidates. There's so many women I know who are articulating something very different. Mm. And I could give you names. I mean, the people in Cork, in Kerry, over in Sligo. It's great that there is now a set of smaller parties, although they've made a lot of progress. For example, if you look at the most recent polls, and you're looking at the can I call them the leftist fringe, and that's fine, they're doing sincere work. But you look at the other parties who support democracy and inclusion, who represent voices that have been pushed aside. And you really have a very good vision about how to progress this country. And you have a politics where the dissonant voice is acknowledged. I'll give you one small example. One of my heroes is, and not for political reasons particularly, Peter Matthews, God rest his soul. I mean, Peter was such a good guy. Mm. He was well-read, he was a gentleman, he engaged with people, but he had a view based on his conscience, which wasn't recognised. So really the only people you're seeing coming through the parties who have abandoned their foundational values are people who are on message. Mm. You know what? Democracy needs people who are that little bit different, yeah, and who have the character to manage that. So that's why this election is so important. It's important for democracy, for human rights, and also because hopefully it will produce in Europe a sense of coming together, a greater balance between the hegemonistic, militaristic view of Macron and those who say, no, Europe is about peace and not about an army. And you know what? We can work together where nations are respected.
Ray Kinsella, Professor of Banking and Financial Services at UCD, thank you so much for speaking to us this morning.
It's a pleasure. And very best to Wendy herself and Matt are at home today.
That's
so
right,
yeah. A big shout out to them.
Absolutely.
I hope she's really enjoying her maternity.
I certainly do too. we talk to our next guest about the on a regular basis about the work that Tear Fund are doing, and it is indeed Niamh Daly. Niamh, how are you doing?
Good morning. Good morning, Ronan. Yes. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, good, and it's great to be chatting to you again. So we have updates from a couple of different areas. We're starting off with Uganda. Can you tell me what's going on there?
Yeah, so really just to talk about what our work there in Uganda, we work through our partner, it's called the Pentecostals Assemblies of God there, and they're one of the largest evangelical denominations in Uganda. And their real aim is to mobilize churches and communities in a district about 200 kilometers from the capital, Kampala. And really their main thinking behind their method really of lifting people out of poverty is to help people realize that they're not without their own resources. And they use stories like, if you're familiar with the story of Elisha in the Bible in 2 Kings and the story of the young boy in the New Testament who gave his lunch to Jesus and he fed 5,000 with it. So really helping people to look at their own resources and see what they can do to lift themselves out of poverty.
For example, one church has been studying what Jesus meant when he said the church is to be the salt of the earth.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we have a story there. There's a church who really were looking at what that meant and really asking themselves what the use of salt means in everyday life. And they said, things like it heals wounds, it makes food taste better, some use it to soften certain types of food. And they really saw that the church needs to be similar in character, preserving good values in the community, helping people who are hurting or in broken relationships, and caring just as Jesus did. And they really recognized, I suppose, that they hadn't been doing that. They had visited people and preached to them. Maybe they'd actually preached at them, Ronan. They definitely weren't this, vision that Jesus had, that they would be the salt of the earth. And they'd really, kept all the other good qualities in their salt shaker, if you like. The salt is still very much in the salt shaker. But they came across a family, John and his wife, Alice, and they started to visit them. Now, they were in a difficult position. They had 7 children, and John was seriously ill, and they were living with many needs, and there wasn't enough money or food, and they were very worried about their future. And so this time round, the church members really spent time listening to the family and taking on board their concerns, and then asking for permission to pray with them, if you like. So very different kind of approach. Now, it turned out, sadly, after this time, John's condition deteriorated, and he did pass away. And Alice was in distraught, really, because tradition there in that region of Kampala is that John's family really take over for the funeral and are responsible for his burial, and really to keep appearances up or whatever really the tradition is there. The family had decided, his clan, to sell the family home and the land to pay for a coffin and an elaborate funeral for John. So Alice, as you can imagine, was distraught, and she turned to her new church family, and they had now really grasped what it meant to be the salt of the earth, thankfully, and they said to Alice, listen, leave it to us, we're here for you and your family. And really, as a church body, they approached John's family clan, and they offered to, amongst themselves, raise the funds to bury John. And they also ended up repairing some of Alice's home so she could keep it, and are now really helping her send 2 of her daughters to school. So a real story of practical transformation there.
That's excellent.
Really,
yeah.
Generated out of an understanding of what Jesus meant when he said, you're the salt of the earth.
Salt of the earth. And I was just thinking, you're really meeting people in their need. And, I suppose I've been thinking about it in my own gig, as a therapist, you end up realizing that if people never get out of that terror of not being able to survive, you can't really talk to them about higher things, can you?
No. There's another phrase you hear, like, hungry bellies have no ears,
Exactly.
And really you have to meet people where their need is at and then bring them on a journey,
So. Excellent. So we also wanted to talk to you, moving on, about the problem with volunteering in orphanages. I find this story absolutely fascinating because I know, people went in there, hundreds and possibly thousands, to help out at orphanages various places around the world over the last 20, even 30 years.
Yeah. And it is really growing momentum, the new thinking around volunteering overseas. And it is, it is hard, I think, for people to get their heads around some of the statistics and the research that's coming out of this. And I know myself, I've lots of people and friends who've done similar, volunteered overseas with the best of intentions. But it's really coming to the front now, the problem that orphanage volunteering is really, the problems are really being exposed with it, you know. So if you can imagine, you have children who
are... What are the problems?
Well, you have children who are without the security of their own family, and so then a volunteer comes in, it might be for a short or maybe even up to 12-week period, and without the security of a family, they become very attached to this individual. Yeah. Who then, you know, moves on and comes back to the West. And so it's this constant loss experienced by children where there's attachment and
They form an attachment with this. They become like the attachment figure or the attachment object. And then what happens is this person, having had their experience, of outreach or helping or volunteering, goes back to the West feeling like that was a fantastic experience. And this child is completely devastated because the one and only person they've attached to is gone.
That is exactly it, Ronan. And then it happens next year again when the volunteers come in June to September.
I can only imagine what the long-term impact on the psychology of a small child would be.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm sure now, as you flagged your own experience there as a therapist, you know, this constant attachment, loss, vulnerability, being reinforced, you know. Absolutely. So there's that issue, but then there's a bigger problem with orphanages, because it's estimated there's around 8 million children in orphanages around the world, but actually 80% of them have a living parent. So our thinking really needs to change about how we support these vulnerable kids, because what's happening really is that families are giving their children into orphanages out of the hope that they'll have a better future, they'll have 3 meals a day and an education, but actually at the end of the process these children are very vulnerable to being trafficked, they've become institutionalized. They've become very disconnected with their original family, who they haven't seen for the good 10, 15 years at a time. And it's really perpetuating a bigger problem than it's solving.
Yeah, it's really... So in what you're really saying is that the entire philosophy behind the idea of orphanages, because presumably orphanages were originally set up for the truly orphaned, you know, the ones who literally had no parents.
And double orphaned,
as you put it. Yeah, exactly. And then slowly we start getting into a place, and I know we really have an enormous history of this, where actually the inconvenient child is also put into the orphanage, because, you know, the reality is that actually whether it's to do with society can't support them or family can't support them or whatever it may happen to be. And actually, so is there then this kind of feeling of like, if we have a certain amount of resources that we're going to plug in anyway, that actually there might be more, you know, there might be more bang for your buck, or there might be more impact, or there might be sort of positive impact in society by going, well, look, we can help them, hopefully support them staying in the family, almost like the way social work works.
Absolutely, absolutely, you know, and it actually makes more economic sense. It costs 10 times more to keep a child in an orphanage than support them in, you know, in their extended family.
Ten times more.
That's mad.
Yeah, that's so. Really, you can do an awful lot. You can really do an awful lot more. Actually, if you've even and tell me, are you finding that as you do this kind of work, that there is that you have to persuade the parents that actually home is a better place for them, or do parents understand that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, parents. We've been involved in reintegration mainly in Cambodia. Some in Nepal, and we have a different program in Zimbabwe, which, you know, is all around keeping children away from being institutionalized, really, and reconnecting them with their families. And the families are absolutely, you know, very on board of taking back their child. And, you know, when they understand that an orphanage in their area is now being closed by the government, or, you know, there's an alternative, that there will be support for this child to send them to school locally with the family, connect them with their cousins, there will be, you know, weekly help, there'll be livelihood, and then maybe the father of the family who wasn't able to provide for himself will be given training in agriculture. You know, there hasn't been any sort of kickback on that side at all.
It just shows you. Kind of like pushing in an open door, really, in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah.
Before I let you go, Niamh, I want to talk about the World Environment Day.
Yeah, that's coming up in early June, and really, our Y-Tier Fund are in this space about talking about the environment and climate justice, and is because we see the people who are most impacted by it on at the front face. You know, it's people living on the floodplains with tinned roof housing that when a hurricane comes 10 times stronger this year than it did for the last 5 years, their homes and their livelihoods are just completely washed out. And so that's why we're concerned about this growing dangers around living off the planet in the excessive ways that we are, and because we do really see that those who are impacted the most are the poorest and the most vulnerable. And really, to mark that and to really help our supporters in some practical day-to-day ways to reduce their impact on the environment, we're going to show a screening of the National Geographic's movie called, or documentary called, Before the Flood. Now, Leonardo DiCaprio, he really MCs the whole documentary. He was involved with the UN around the issue of climate justice for a number of years. And so really the documentary plots his whole experience of the whole climate change debate and gives some good, really good practical insights into the issue. So do come along. It's on it's in the nice Beauties Cafe on Grafton Street.
Beautiful.
It's on Wednesday, June 12th at 7 p.m. in the evening. There'll be some cookies and coffee, and we'll have a good chat, and
great,
we'll give you some practical lifestyle suggestions on things you can swap around to make a difference.
That's a couple of weeks away yet. Wednesday, June the 12th, so we might give that another mention closer to the time. But it is Beauty's Cafe, Grafton Street, Wednesday, June the 12th at 7 p.m. For the screening of National Geographic's Leonardo DiCaprio documentary Before the Flood. Niamh Daly, Marketing and Fundraising Manager from Tier Fund, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.